Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
This is a pre-recorded show by Carl. I'm Carl's executive producer. Ha ha. It was recorded on August 27th this year, and you can call in. I will visit with you, but it is pre-recorded, so we will not interrupt the show while. For the other listeners, but I will visit with you in the green room. So follow the orders, you know, if you want to visit in the green room, 646-716-8652, on with the show.
This is the Abolitionist Hour, knee deep in the big muddy, and the big fool says, push on. There was trouble at City Hall, Kansas City, when one arrest by a representative of KC Tenants protested the neoliberal gentrification of Kansas City's east side. But first, PJ Harvey.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back.
This is war. Protester arrested as KC approves change to housing affordability rate. Chaos erupted Thursday at City Hall as Kansas City Mayor Quinton Lucas shouted for his colleagues to keep voting over the chanting of KC tenants members who overpowered the council meeting. One leader with the advocacy group was arrested and escorted out of council chambers as dozens of KC tenants members demonstrated against an ordinance proposed by Lucas that would grow the city's housing inventory. Lucas' proposal eases the requirements for developers to create affordable housing. Opponents have balked at the city's calculation for affordability, which would classify nearly $1,200 a month for a one-bedroom apartment as affordable. Critics have said this cost doesn't reflect affordable rent options for most working-class Kansas Cityans. Others have said the plan was too rushed. An attempt by Councilwoman Andrea Bau, District 6 at large, to hold the ordinance a week failed. Councilwoman Melissa Robinson, who represents District 3 on the east side, voted in favor of the ordinance, arguing that it would make way for more homes and a growing middle class in the district. Robinson grew up in the district where she shared a block with professionals like doctors and a judge. She wants to see that again. We need people to come back home to the 3rd district, she said. Yet, she acknowledged that the ordinance is not going to improve living situations for those most vulnerable. This is not affordability for everyone, she said. But it's affordability for some people, especially middle-class people. But Councilman Brandon Ellington, District 3 at large, noted that the ordinance does nothing to incentivize development in distressed parts of the city. This ain't for the east side, he said. This ain't for the 3rd district. Ellington underscored that all the ordinance does is change the affordability threshold for developers. Anything else is theory, he said. The ordinance ultimately passed 9-4 before the overwhelming chance of KC tenants forced council members to prematurely adjourn the meeting and hold over remaining agenda items until next week. Ellington voted against the ordinance alongside Bau, Councilman Eric Bunch, District 4, and Heather Hall, District 1. The council also moved legislation putting a $175 million bond issue before voters in November. If approved, the new debt would fund improvements to Bartle Hall, city pools and add $50 million into the city's Affordable Housing Trust Fund. All council members but Ellington voted in favor. The housing plan. The housing plan will create more lenient affordable housing requirements for private developers seeking city incentives. Under this change, the city will need to set aside fewer affordable units or the cost of units marked affordable will be raised. Lucas' legislative package is in response to a measure unanimously approved by council in January 2021 requiring that real estate developers seeking government financial aid include affordable units in most apartment projects, or pay into the housing trust fund. That legislation required one-fifth of the units in most taxpayer-subsidized apartment buildings to be affordable. Half of those had to be affordable to families earning 70% of the area median income and the other half to those earning 30%. The new proposal changes that. In exchange for incentives, developers will have to set aside one-fifth of their units to those earning 60% of the area median income. At that rate, the city would deem a one-bedroom apartment that costs $1,172 per month affordable to a single person. A family of three earning about $53,000 per year, for example, would qualify for a subsidized two-bedroom apartment that rents for $1,319 per month. In the past 18 months, since that legislation passed, no new apartment complexes seeking taxpayer-funded incentives were proposed in Kansas City. Lucas has said he hopes the latest legislation will boost the supply of housing in the city and help slow the rapid rise in rents for people who can least afford it. Those who put more than half their income towards housing are considered severely cost-burdened. This can affect people's ability to afford other essential items, like groceries. In Kansas City, the median cost of rent is $1,326, up 13% since July 2021. In certain zip codes, the median rent price is up by 42%. For many, these housing costs are rising much faster than incomes, Michael Frisch, urban planning professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, previously told the Star. KC Tenants has pointed to inflation as a reason for affordability numbers looking higher than expected. Tiana Caldwell, an organizer with the group and a member of the city's health commission, was the sole person arrested Thursday, KC Tenants leaders said. I helped to found KC Tenants 3.5 years ago and the mayor looked me in the face and promised he would fight for me. Now he's selling me out, she said in a statement Thursday afternoon. They showed me I have to fight to survive. I'll keep fighting. I'm going to be here and they're going to have to face me every time. I have no fear. This is war. This story was originally published August 18, 2022, 8:38 p.m.
Next article.
There long has been a debate among social policy advocates and politicians over which makes better policy and is more politically sustainable. Universal programs like Social Security and Medicare or targeted ones like Medicaid and food stamps. The assumption is that universal programs fare better as, by definition, they have more beneficiaries. Conventional wisdom has it that during the Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush presidencies, programs focused on the poor were shredded, while universal programs escaped unscathed. In a major study for the Hamilton Project and Brookings Institution, Bob Greenstein, the Michelangelo of social programs to lift people out of poverty going back to the 1970s, reports this conventional wisdom is essentially wrong. Over 40 years, after adjusting for inflation and population, he found that programs targeted by income rose at an annual rate of 3.39%, while universal programs rose an average of 2.36% a year. Policymakers effectively developed a new model for targeted programs aimed at poor families, extending them to families well above the poverty level even into middle class, he told me. Greenstein takes issue with critics who say this is just universal light, with programs like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps, or the Earned Income Tax Credit or Medicaid. Almost all the benefits go to people below the median income level in the country, and most of the benefits go to people in the bottom quintile. The Greenstein paper found that from 1979 to 2019, Medicare, which mainly serves the elderly, annually rose a robust 4.12% after adjusting for inflation and population. Medicaid, once seen as just for the poor, grew at an even faster 4.94% as eligibility expanded. There are more than 82 million Americans enrolled in Medicaid, less than half living below the poverty level, and almost half of all births are covered by Medicaid. That explains the Republicans' political failure to cut Medicaid, which is funded mainly by the federal government with states kicking in a share. Obamacare offered extended benefits, but a number of Republican-led states rejected that. However, when proponents put it on the ballot as a referendum, it won in deeply red states like Oklahoma, Utah, and Missouri. This summer, South Dakota voters resoundingly rejected a proposal by Republican legislators to make it more difficult to approve a Medicaid expansion initiative. In his research, Greenstein cited overall qualities that make programs more sustainable, including, when tied to work, when also serving families significantly above the poverty line, even into middle class, when federally financed and administered, when providing in-kind assistance, not cash, either directly or through the tax code, and when they focus on children, the elderly or those with disabilities. Welfare, what used to be called AFDC and now TANF, temporary assistance for needy families, fared poorly, being repeatedly cut. But supplemental nutrition assistance programs have flourished, either through stamps or electronic transfers, providing food assistance to families, in good and bad times. The modern food stamp program was devised in the 1970s by a diverse set of influential legislators, Representative Tom Foley, who later became Speaker, and Senators Bob Dole, a conservative, and liberal George McGovern. They put the measure in the Farm Bill, winning support from rural lawmakers who wanted farm subsidies, and urban liberals then backed the agricultural programs. Assistance that goes through the tax code is easier to garner political support. The Earned Income Tax Credit for the working poor has been enormously successful and popular. So has the Child Tax Credit, which provides a credit of up to $2,000 for children up to 17. The credit was temporarily boosted during the pandemic, but wasn't extended in the big domestic bill Democrats just passed. Hopefully it might be next year, and made refundable, so it could help the really poor who pay little or no taxes while reducing the eligibility threshold. Now a couple making as much as $450,000 can get some of the credit. That's well beyond middle class. Most any new universal programs are doomed because of the cost. In the recent congressional legislation, House Democrats scrapped a plan to include dental and vision benefits under Medicare because of the price tag. The dream of some liberals for a universal basic income will remain a dream, so will any hope for a single-payer health care plan. Advocates will have to focus on expanding Obamacare. The tax increases needed to support universal programs are unattainable, even though, as Greenstein notes, the United States is a low-tax country. A couple years ago, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, tax revenue in the U.S. equaled 25% of gross domestic product. In Western European countries, that rate ranged between 33% and 47%. There will be competing claims for any domestic initiatives. Both Social Security and Medicare need to be financially bolstered in this decade. Even after an expansive agenda enacted in this Congress, there are unmet needs, especially for children. One possibly helpful step may be a little-noticed executive order that President Biden signed last December directing federal agencies to better coordinate in cutting through red tape and bureaucratic overlap in some of these initiatives. This has the potential to be a big deal, Greenstein says. It can build on the progress that has been made in making it easier to apply and remain enrolled in these programs without impairing program integrity. Al Hunt is the former executive editor of Bloomberg News. He previously served as reporter, bureau chief, and Washington editor for the Wall Street Journal.
Next article.
Johnson County abortion vote holds steady with recount. One Kansas county still to finish. Johnson County finished its recount of Kansas landslide abortion vote Saturday, revealing no significant changes in outcome and affirming the county's overwhelming support of state-level abortion rights. The county's canvass board convened Saturday morning to announce and certify the official results of the hand recount. Sedgwick County is the final remaining county to release its official recount results, and the county has not set a time to certify their results. In total, 38 votes changed, a minuscule fraction of the more than 250,000 ballots cast in Johnson County. The county counted 18 fewer yes votes and 20 fewer no votes than the original count, said Election Commissioner Fred Sherman. There was probably some human elements done in these mismatched numbers because of a compressed time frame that you have to complete the task in. Johnson County's results further confirm the recount is unlikely to result in any significant changes to the vote that affirmed abortion rights in Kansas. Kansans rejected the proposed constitutional amendment, which would have stripped the right to an abortion from the state constitution, 59% to 41%. The gap was more than 165,000 votes. Mark Geetson, a Wichita anti-abortion activist, and Melissa Levitt, a Colby election denier, scraped together around $120,000 Monday to force a hand recount of the abortion rights affirming vote in nine counties. The counties accounted for nearly 60% of the vote. Levitt and Geetson made unfounded and vague claims of election fraud. Unable to pay for a recount in the entire state, they chose Kansas' two largest counties, Johnson and Sedgwick, as well as Douglas, Shawnee, Crawford, Harvey, Jefferson, Lyon, and Thomas. Every county but Johnson and Sedgwick finished their recounts by Friday. Data from the counties and the Kansas Secretary of State's office showed minimal changes in the seven counties that finished by Friday.
Next article.
Thank you.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. An August economic update with Mark and Kerry with an outlook from London and D.C. Check out Mark and Kerry on YouTube. But first, PJ.
Welcome to Mark and Kerry. Hello, Blythe. We're in our COVID locations since we're on Zoom.
Exactly. Even though there's no COVID now,
right.
Or maybe there is, I'm not sure. But we're pretending it's not there, and it seems to be working.
Yes, actually,
so that's great.
Kim Jong-un declared it was over in North Korea, so therefore it must be over.
So therefore,
yes.
It's over. Excellent. So you're in D.C. What's it like in the swamp?
You know, actually, it's quite pleasant right now. Low humidity. It's like 88 degrees, which feels like heaven. So it's actually pleasant to be outside at the moment.
Fantastic. It was actually cold here yesterday, but now it's back up to, like, I think 91 or something like that. What's been going on?
Well, I mean, the news has just really perked up a lot of the, you know, Democrats, which, you know, are naysayers about everything since we last spoke. Biden administration got a lot of stuff passed, or not the big thing passed, the Inflation Reduction Act, which we talked about last time, but also some stuff that was big jobs numbers, like 600,000 jobs added from the July jobs report. Inflation has come down a few, like half a percentage point or something like that. And it looks like gas is down by like a dollar in some places. So these are all good signals, which of course have Democrats like thinking home run. Maybe we won't lose the House by, you know, there'll be a, you know, won't be as terrible as one thought just a few weeks ago. The Senate maybe will be more competitive in the midterms, maybe plus or minus one or two seats for, you know, might not be, again, a thrashing as predicted. But, you know, I mean, this is all sounds really good in August. And then, you know, as we get deeper into September, it looks a little bit worse probably.
I'll believe it when I can pull the Bloomberg data for the Michigan Confidence Index and then divide it by partisanship.
Yeah.
Because I believe that Democrats are feeling a lot better at the economy, but nothing's going to shift self-identified Republicans because that's just the way that we've become. Right? The actual data doesn't matter.
And also thinking about the gas, I mean, you'll appreciate this as an economist and me as like a, you know, wannabe economist. Isn't it a supply and demand issue that it was really high and there's less demand, so the price goes down, or is that too basic?
There's a new Chicago Fed paper that's out, which basically says if you compare, you know, Europe and the United States, Europe is entirely food and fuel, right? Really bad hot summer, crop failures, effects of Ukraine on basic cereals, gas shortage cause of Russia, oil price spike. Very, very hot weather leads to two warm rivers in France, so they can't cool the nuclear power plant.
Yeah.
So they need to shut them down, so there's less electricity, so the price goes up. That's the European story, right? And the American story, the one thing that stands out in driving inflation, this is brilliant. I used to say this as a joke, that inflation was caused by everyone being on Zoom and looking behind them all at once and saying, we need to replace that couch. It turns out it's true. The largest single driver of U.S. inflation from 21 to 22 was consumer durables, which were in short supply because of COVID damaged supply chains. This goes back to this whole thing of like, and why are we raising interest rates? What does interest rates have to do with any of this? This isn't a wage price spiral. Real wages are down again. But at the same time, right, really weird, as you pointed out, that really big jobs number. So we're raising interest rates to induce a recession, and you get the largest monthly jobs gain in, like, you know, in whatever, over a year at least. So, you know, it's a very, very weird and mixed period.
You know, going out there, traveling, et cetera, it feels like instead of buying the sofa or the thing that we needed to replace, that we've moved back to service stuff, that we've moved back to buying, you know, getting your nails done, the haircuts and like that sort of stuff, which could drive the jobs numbers.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, something else I was thinking about with the co-author is we consume something now that we didn't even know existed in the 70s called digital goods. And digital goods basically, you know, are zero marginal cost by and large, right? I mean, somebody has to put up the website. But ultimately, once you have a streaming service, you just put it up there, you pay a fee, and the fee's pretty nominal in comparison to what the alternative of going to the movies every night would be, right? So these things are actually deflators rather than inflators, but like we don't even put them into the index. So, you know, how should we think about this continues to be an interesting question.
Does the UK's Federal Reserve, whatever the name for that is, do they, the Bank of England, do they have the ability to increase interest rates similar to what the Fed does?
Oh, yeah.
And they're not,
yeah,
they
absolutely.
Are or are not doing that?
Well, they are. They're not being quite as aggressive. You know, no one really is because they're kind of hedging it in case they overshoot and basically kill the economy when they don't need to. And it's this whole debate between the inflation hawks who think that we're all on the brink of being the Weimar Republic in, you know, Germany in the 20s versus people like, you know, who are basically saying, you know, it's transitory. And what they mean by that is not just like, oh, it'll be gone next week. But, you know, these are sort of supply side factors that will resolve themselves one way or another. And if they don't resolve themselves, that's the source of your inflation. So why are you thinking this is driven by demand and therefore would, you know, work on interest rates, et cetera?
Hmm.
So one of the things I think is really funny about this moment, like a couple of things. Number one, I did not see Joe Manchin turning. I didn't see that at all. I was absolutely convinced that was never going to happen. And, you know, apparently part of the reason for this is some very serious people from sort of, you know, Bill Gates onwards, just phoned him up and shouted at him. Just said, no, don't do this. This is crazy, right? You know, so there was a lot of lobbying, high-end lobbying that went into it. And then also just the brilliant fact that they've called essentially a slim down Build Back Better the Inflation Reduction Act. It has nothing to do with reducing inflation. It's just absolutely absurd. A couple of bits in it I thought were pretty interesting. The 1% tax on stock buybacks. 1% is nothing, right? Last year, I think, $817 billion, so you're going to get $8 billion. That's not even a rounding error for the federal government. But it's a bit like when they introduced income tax in 1913. It started off at about 1% or 2%. Look where it is now. So that's the thing. Once you've got that in there, you can start to jack it up. Another one that's interesting is the claim that it's going to make 60,000 green manufacturing jobs. I have no idea how you cook up that number. And then the one that Kristen Sinema got in this one, which was she got $500,000 from private equity for her electoral purposes, and she made sure that the private equity firms still get to do this carried interest deduction so that their net income tax is way lower than yours and I.
Oh, I like the point about the 1%, though, that now there's in there, then you can eat.
the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. Slavery and capitalism, you can't divide the two. As a Black August special, we're going to go back to the 15th, 16th century with Dr. Anthony Boggs, as he explains black bodies reduced to labor and nature reduced to land. But first, P.J. Harvey.
Everybody for coming out, and I particularly would like to thank Walter Johnson, Jennifer Morgan, and Seth Rothman for making this particular conversation possible, and to Zach Sell for chairing. Also would like to just send thanks to of appreciation to the Center for Latin American Studies and their Sawyer Seminar Series when they invited the center to participate, and to thank the center staff, both Maya Gamble Rivers and Shayna Weinberg, for organizing this. In the time allocated to me, I want to make a series of remarks drawn from a research project and a book that I'm now doing, tentatively titled Black Critique. The book is a fairly large book, and began as a study of freedom. In the time allocated to me, I want to make a series of remarks drawn from a research project and a book that I'm now doing, tentatively titled Black Critique. The book is a fairly large book and began as a study of freedom, but I realized in writing it that I actually could not do a study of freedom without doing a study of the history of capitalism itself. And so I have had to put aside the sections of the text on freedom and turn to a study of the business of capitalism. This is about 1944 and Eric Williams's Capitalism and Slavery, with the thesis that essentially colonial slavery was a foundation for the Industrial Revolution and for industrial capitalism. There has been a serious debate about capitalism and its relationship to slavery. I want to just put that debate in parenthesis, sort of, or put it in some kind of bracket, because I don't want to start with that debate. I actually want to start with a much earlier book, which is 1935, W.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction. It's actually where the debate should begin. And I'm not quite sure why historians have begun in 1944 and has developed a whole thing on the Williams thesis, when in fact the real thing about capitalism and slavery, or one of the most remarkable texts about capitalism and slavery, emerges in 1935, Du Bois's Black Reconstruction. Think of the beginning of the book of Black Reconstruction. Think of the title of the chapter, The Black Worker, which is essentially changes immediately the category of the enslaved to that of labor. And think of, therefore, what that means theoretically with the transformation of the category of the enslaved to that of worker, and how that troubles a whole set of other ways in which we think about slavery. I would argue that Du Bois's book essentially repositions slavery as central to America's economic development, to capitalism. Think again of the epigraph in chapter one, where he makes it very clear that the arrival of the black man, he says, and here I'm paraphrasing him, to the United States, that he has always been a central part of the economic life of America and its democracy. I think that what Du Bois is trying to make is that capitalism as a mode of production was not separate from racial slavery, that there were not two distinct racial systems, two distinct social systems, but that they were interconnected, and that American slavery could not be called a mode of production or slave production separate from capitalism. Now, the mode of production argument again appears in the 1970s. Dual systems theory, particularly in places like Brazil and in other parts of Latin America. There are a lot of work around Brazil as a slave mode of production, particularly in the 1980s, looking at agricultural lands, as well as looking at the mining processes in Brazil. There's also a vast literature in Latin America in which does not talk about slave mode of production, but talks about the colonial mode of production in Latin America. So in other words, there has been a preoccupation, not just with the questions of slavery and its relationship to capitalism, but there has been a preoccupation as how do you identify slavery itself? What can you call slavery? How can you call slavery as a labor process and as an economic process, not just as a social system? What is the relationship between colonialism and slavery? What I want to suggest that Du Bois did was to shift the gaze from arguments about mode of production or any descriptive argument about what capitalism is, that is primarily a system of wage worker en masse within a factory system, but focuses on labor in a different kind of way. I would want to remind you that when Du Bois was doing Black Reconstruction in 1935, but prior to that in 1933, he was given classes at Atlanta University on capital, which means that he was reading Marx and then trying to think through Marx and its relationship to America. My remarks, therefore, begins with that Du Bois and perspective of labor and its slave labor and its relationship to capitalism. A great deal of historical work over the past decade or so has been done about what is now called the history of capitalism. The good old Cambridge University and Cambridge University Press has published in 2014 a two-volume history. There has been remarkable scholarship produced by members on this panel, Seth, Walter, and Jennifer. There have been many others who are not in this room who have really tried to think about the relationship between capitalism and history. In this particular pattern or trajectory of scholarship, certain categories have emerged. One category is that what is called war capitalism. Another category that was there long before, in particular in the work of Cedric Robinson from 1983, is what has been called racial capitalism. In Europe, Marcel van Leyden has developed a notion of plantation capitalism as a way to begin to think about a different global history of labor. In all of these works, I would want to suggest there are some general features, that of violence, the question of accumulation, the question of circulation, the ways in which economic institutions operate. And also in many of the works, there has been a focus on the 19th century. And of course, in all of the works, there has been a focus on racialized black bodies. I think important in thinking about this body of literature is that there, in the discussions of the histories of capitalism, there have been a certain set of prefaces, so that there is primitive accumulation, which then leads to merchant capitalism, which then merchant capitalism leads to industrial capitalism, which then leads to financial capitalism, and then which then leads us to late capitalism today and neoliberalism. So that there is a way in which the prefix is then used as a designator to describe what exactly capitalism is, or what kind of, what is the periodization of this particular system. I want to trouble that a bit, some of these prefixes and periodization, and I can suggest that in thinking about race, slavery, and capitalism, that we are in a new economic social formation in which questions of that of capitalism, that of commodification, exploitation, alienation, and freedom itself now need to be rethought. One will not have time here for the full argument, but the argument I'm making has enormous political consequences for struggles against various forms of domination, as well as for historical analysis. Let me, for a moment, for example, consider the conventional prefix merchant capital, which is oftentimes subtracted from financial. So it's merchant and then financial capitalism. Of course, one can begin this particular critique by beginning to look at the work of Rosa Luxemburg on her major theoretical work, The Accumulation of Capital, a Contribution to the Economic Explanation of Imperialism, published in Berlin in 1913, in which she begins to talk about enlarged position. But one of the problems of that particular work, as well as on many other works, is not just a question of what some of us call a commercialization thesis, but really as a way in which capitalism is constructed as an abstract pure form, as a kind of ideal form in which laws of society and the laws of motion of capital actually operate. My argument there, however, is that there's really no ideal form, even in any abstract, in any kind of abstractions, and that ideal forms and theoretical abstractions are in fact very brittle. And so that what I like to say is if one is going to theorize a system, then one needs to begin to theorize that system from a set of historical experiences and to do what I call theory from history. Therefore, let's just get a little bit historically concrete, keeping in mind the business of the categories of merchant and finance. And let me go immediately to the Netherlands and to a company that was formed called the VOC. The VOC is formed in 1602. The capital of the VOC is 6.5 million guilders at that particular point in time. It has 200 shareholders. It has a board of directors. It is a transnational company. I'm talking 1602. It is a transnational company. Its central office is in Amsterdam. It employs 350 persons. Its portfolio, when you look at its books, contains the following things: slave trade, plantation investments, both in the Caribbean as well as Indonesia, investment in the spinning wheel in India, investments in South Africa. The laws and the regulation, or the regulation governing the VOC, is that it can conduct war, it can conclude treaties, it can take possession of land, and it can build fortresses. Now, to me, what you're looking at, therefore, is not now just a trading company. What you're looking at is both a finance and a trading company. And its sister company, Westinghouse Company, is essentially constructed very similarly, but it has a lot more heavy side to it with investment houses. And these investment houses are important because these are the investment houses that does two things. One, they do engage in the slave trade. And secondly, they give money to the planters in Suriname, particularly in the Caribbean, to set up their plantations. It's really very funny. I mean, I was reading some of their account books, and what was interesting was not only do they give the money to the credit to the planters to actually set up the plantations, but they actually buy the source of food for the slaves and the planters, sell it to them at a profit. Right? So that it's really a total system, but it's a system actually based on a certain kind of investment. So what you really have are merchant bankers, and that these merchant bankers who run these particular investment houses, therefore, in my view, complicate the idea that somehow this is really merchant capitalism, mercantile capitalism, and then financial capitalism later on in the 19th century. Well, what you really have, in my view, is actually the dominance of finance. And how does one see this? There are 2,000 plantations in the small territory of Suriname. One of the very first collapse of the stock exchanges that we now have in economic history is 1773 in Amsterdam. What's the problem why you have the stock exchange crash? You have this problem because the investment houses have given the planters in Suriname money for their plantations. The planters cannot pay it back. So there is a debt crisis. When one looks at the numbers, it's not really a serious debt crisis, but there is a panic that somehow this will be larger than what has been there before. And then this leads to a crash in 1773 in the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. What is important, as I'm saying to you, is that here you are one of the first stock exchanges in the world, but at the foundation of that, which is a financial instrument, that is actually plantation, is racial slavery. Or you can take another company, if you want to leave the Dutch and go to the English, and take the English South Sea Company of 1720, in which Isaac Newton is an investor. And what is interesting is that how that company again crashes, but it doesn't crash because people think that the people can't pay back debt, but because there is a rumor that the people will not be able to pay back their debt. And as Isaac Newton said, I can understand astronomy, I can understand the stars, but I cannot understand, as he says, the multitude's madness. And so what I would want to suggest is that what we have, therefore, is that the colonial enterprise is an enterprise of merchants and of bankers, and that of the slavery enterprise is an enterprise of merchants, bankers, and plantations. To think about this a little bit deeper, one might want to then think about the plantation itself, since we're looking at racial slavery. And a lot of the ideas that we have of the plantation is that it is primarily agricultural. And I would want to suggest to you that's not so. That in fact, the way in which the plantation was structured was really agro-industry. If you think of the Barbadian plantations, for example, and the production of sugar, if you think of the Brazilian plantations, if you think of even of the production of Brazilian mine in Brazil in the 1800s, before the abolition of slavery, what you see is not just that people are doing sugar, that is cutting cane, that they're actually making sugar, and that there's a process of making sugar. So there is a industrial process. And one of the fascinating things about this is that when you look at some of the work of the planters, they begin to call the particular plantations what they call a perfect machine. And the idea, the language of a perfect machine, therefore, is about trying to run a certain kind of industry. So what I would want to suggest, therefore, we might want to shift away from talking about a certain kind of capitalism as war capitalism, because, in fact, colonial capitalism, if you want to call it that, it was about conquest and war. It is part of the way in which colonialism operates is about conquest, it's about war, it's about taking territory, etc. So that, therefore, that's what it unleashes. And that we might want to think about what I'm tentatively calling something called slave capitalism. That is a way in which, going back to pre-physics, a way in which we can think through the question of labor, a way we can think through the question of anti-black racism, way in which we can think about what I'm calling the double commodification of labor. In other words, the ways in which the slave is not, the enslaved is not just a person, labor power that produces something, but that is his or her body is also property. And therefore, that particular process of double commodification. And to then therefore think, what does that process of double commodification mean when we begin to think about not now just questions of exploitation, but questions of alienation, questions and questions of domination. So that while we need prefixes and about to try to help us analytically to come to grips with slavery and racial slavery, one of the things I would want to suggest is that in this business of trying to think through the how the system actually works, one of the things that a very good theorist says in an unpublished manuscript makes the point, Sylvia Winter, what you're looking at is the reduction of man to labor and the reduction of nature to land. And what Ranald calls in his 1770s book on the history of the Indies, odious commerce. And so therefore, to think about this particular reduction, to think about these processes of double commodification of the enslaved, means in my view that you are now really have to think through a different conception of freedom. That no longer can you think about human emancipation as only circling around questions of wage labor, but now you have to begin to think about the questions of human emancipation circling around this business of formal human domination. And therefore, it would just seem to me that one of the important questions of trying to think about a new history of capitalism is really also to think about a new history of what freedom might mean. Freedom might mean.
Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. We continue with our Black August special with Jennifer Morgan, Wealth Transfer Through Colonial Capitalism. But first, PJ Harvey.
Time still As vistas to the east expanded, I think a range of material and ideological technologies came into play for rulers, for merchants, for ideologues, and for travelers in both Europe and West Africa. Numeracy, which is my way of capturing a whole range of ideas about rationality, about numbers, about trade, about currency, about attention to demography. All of these were just some of the new modes of thinking that accompanied the origins of the modern Atlantic world. In England and on the West African coast, traders and scholars were reconsidering their understanding of wealth, of trade, and the ways in which states benefited from an idea of population. For English theorists, that notion of counting population is called political arithmetic, and it becomes demography and understanding demographic strengths and vulnerabilities. On the African coast, traders began to see populations as marketable in new and more fungible ways as slavery came to mean something entirely different. And by this, I mean African traders. I mean I don't mean European traders who are on the coast. As slavery came to mean something entirely different and was premised on an unspoken idea that population was somehow infinite. Simultaneously, the language of race and racial hierarchy shifted longstanding concepts of who was different, who was foreign, who was an ally, who was an enemy, and emerged to shape the trade in slavery, in the goods produced by slave labor, and in the settler colonialism that would come to comprise the core means by which wealth was transferred across and around the Atlantic. So both numeracy and race thinking shaped and were shaped by the social and cultural processes that attended their use. Neither are fixed or static tools, but together they forged rationalized meaning through the interplay between the supposed logic of calculus and the alchemy of race making. This is all a lot of shorthand, which I'm happy to talk about a little bit more. Historians have long agreed that the economic transformations of the late 16th and the early 17th century were accompanied by new symbolic meanings that far exceeded the economy. But somehow that understanding stops sort of inside of Europe and doesn't include slavery. I mean, our most foundational theorists of early histories of capitalism, I'm thinking about Braudel, for example, who, as he introduces the concept of the labor market, says, in a kind of parenthesis, he says that he, as Marx did, quote, will leave aside the classic case of slavery, which was, however, to be prolonged and even renewed. And this gesture of saying, like, yes, slavery, but I'm not going to talk about it because I'm talking about Europe, is really the groundwork on which many revisionists stand. New ways of thinking were the norm in 17th century England, which is where I'm, working right now. And contemporary observers understood that significant shifts were underway regarding the role of merchants and traders in producing the wealth of monarchies and states. They were careful and assiduous in trying to explain these new ways of thinking. 17th century English policy around trade and commerce reflected a crucial moment in the development of Atlantic markets, and it was at this moment that foundational commitments to an empire rooted in colonial commodities markets and dependent on slave labor took hold. So we see that and we understand that if we're reading the history of political economy. But what we don't ever do, or what we rarely do, is think about the experience of those people who are being transformed into commodities in this early period, not in the 18th century and the 19th century, but right at the time when it's beginning, under the hands of the Portuguese and the Spanish, and then ultimately other European nations. And we don't turn that gaze back to think about how they are also producing, in some ways, theories of early commodification and of early capitalism. And so that effort to try to kind of read the archive back on this process is at the heart of what I'm involved in. I think that we need to ask questions about the way that hereditary racial slavery emerges at a moment in which all sorts of questions about population, about currency, and about trade and about value are circulating. They're circulating out of Europe, they're circulating on the West African coast, and they are being transformed. The questions that I'm asking are clearly related to and in dialogue with the newly invigorated scholarship on capitalism and slavery that has followed Eric Williams' foundational work and that is exemplified by the crucial work of my fellow panelists. I think, though, that I'm asking a slightly different set of questions as I come to this not from the perspective of a scholar of capital, but rather as a scholar of gendered power and of racialized intimacy. It's this location that shapes my interest less in the structural relationship between slavery and capitalism and more with emergent cultural practices in which the fungibility of humans and the growth of early modern slave societies is rendered logical, because it's in that logic, it is that logic that hides the subjects that I'm most interested in understanding. And therefore, as I grapple with the archive that's available to me, it's the process of rendering questions unanswerable that is most crucial to my work. And so for me, what is the most important thing about the intersection between slavery and capitalism in the early modern period is the way that it transforms certain subjects into marginalia. So the subjects that, and by subjects I mean intellectual subjects, but also the people, so that those women whose bodies are producing hereditary racial slavery and whose bodies are the site of law and theory and new power relations are then erased from our archive in ways that everybody in this room is intimately familiar with, but that are ways that we still really need to continue to focus on.
I've been trying to show you over and over. Look at these, my childbearing lips. Look at these, my ruby red, ruby lips. Look at these, my work strong arms. You got to see my ball full of charm. I lay it all at your feet. You turn around and say it back to me. He said, she on again. Yeah. You ain't sufficient.
Logistically. So we're talking August, September, October. We can't get there till November 1. In those 3 months, at the pace at which this war is going, so much is happening. Either the Japanese would have crumbled, the Russians would have come. In any case, Curtis LeMay, who was the greatest terror bomber of all time, he beats anybody Bush would have sent out there. But even Curtis LeMay said, you know, despite the atomic bombs and despite the Russian invasion, the Japanese would have surrendered within 2 weeks. That was LeMay's opinion. And most of the five-star officers felt the same way. You know, why? We won this war. We won it in the Pacific, the Americans did, and the Soviets essentially won it in Europe, as well as helped us in the Japanese war. But we won it. Why? We didn't even have to invade the mainland. Just let them surrender. But we spent a lot of money building these bombs, a lot. And it's the American way. You want to know if it works, right? You don't want to sit around and just like all of a sudden spend a few billion dollars and then leave it in some warehouse somewhere. We would have wondered, does it work? And that's the American way. But I think far more important was the American emerging position on the Soviet Union, which starts to emerge basically in 1944 again when the Republicans start to get back into Congress. So the anti-communist thing comes back into play from World War I and Woodrow Wilson's days. But all this you need to know. You've got to educate yourself. Because the Soviets were our allies. They were waiting for $10 billion reparation from us. Right? They promised it. They were broke. They were desperate. They could have been our allies. But we chose to, Churchill was a chose to back the British Empire. Now, the British Empire, we show maps of this, very interesting maps. The British Empire is a dominant institution in the world before World War II. We show a map that shows you the influence from all the way from England through to Singapore, India, Suez, the Middle East, the Balkans, Greece, and so forth, Iran. It's an amazing map, and it tells you, I think maps, that's what visuals do. They cut through the bullshit sometimes. And so in a movie, you can show that. But that map is extraordinary because it shows what the British are really fighting for and what Churchill stands for, which is I did not become Prime Minister of this country to preside over the dissolution of the British Empire. And everything we do in Truman, when Truman becomes, and Roosevelt resented that and was very anti-colonial in his speeches and his rhetoric. And even as early as 1944, in a key moment, Churchill, after a bloody fight in Greece, fought by the communists, the Greek communist resistance for the most part, against the Nazis. And they paid a high price. It was a bloody fight, as it was in Yugoslavia, in the mountains. It was British, though. Greece was British, and Churchill wanted back in. He went to Moscow in 44 after, secretly, quietly. I mean, it was a two-person deal. Him and Stalin, they sat down. They divided the map. They called it the naughty document. Churchill called it his naughty document. We show it in there. They divide up Eastern Europe, which is, okay, that's the victor, you know, the victors divide the spoils.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, facing labor shortages in the Arkansas prison system. Almost 300 raids by probation, parole, state police, city police, and county police rendered several weapons, several arrests. But first, PJ Harvey Band.
Good afternoon. I'm Bill Bryant, the colonel of the Arkansas State Police, and we're very fortunate with our governor. He is a strong supporter of the rule of law and has always supported law enforcement. But I just want to visit a couple of weeks ago when we had all the shootings in the Little Rock area, and just wanted to kind of inform you how it took place a little bit, that right away we established communication with Interim Chief Wayne Bewley of the Little Rock Police Department. We saw the number of shootings occurring. We established a unified command at the Arkansas State Police. We got the information out quickly of what we had. Fortunately, one of our troopers observed the vehicle. He got back up, and we ended up getting in pursuit with the vehicle. But we also, what we did is we brought in over 32 troopers that day. We have call an all-call in Troop A, where we brought in 32 troopers, where we saturated the interstates until we could capture the suspect. There was a great joint operation between us, the Little Rock Police Department, and the Pulaski County Sheriff's Office.
Good afternoon. First begin by thanking the governor for his support of our intensive supervision efforts here in Central Arkansas. We know there is a segment of our community supervision population that, because of their previous criminal history, is at a higher risk, and we want to make sure that we have adequate resources in place to give that segment of our population the adequate attention that it requires. The numbers that the governor presented speak for themselves. As we have increased the resources for this program, we have seen increases in confiscation, both of illegal narcotics, but also of weapons, with the numbers of arrests being made by that program. Of those 295 home visits, which was a collaboration between our intensive supervision team and our regular parole and probation officers, we had 172 direct contacts, resulting in 7 arrests for new felony charges over the weekend and an additional 5 firearms that were confiscated. We have strengthened the penalties that these offenders are subjected to for carrying a firearm, and we have to make sure that we are implementing those penalties to the fullest extent of the law in order to protect our communities.
The state of Florida has charged and is in the process of arresting 20 individuals across the state for voter fraud.
His latest book is titled Let My People Vote, My Battle to Restore the Civil Rights of Returning Citizens.
Thank you.
These things are what happen in banana republics, where dictators have federal agencies, including law enforcement, to act as their own personal goon squad. This is something that every American should be extremely concerned about.
I lost my heart.
What I found, that blue.
It's the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. Darwina Dugan died last weekend, killed by a car bomb in Moscow. But first, PJ Harvey.
God.
To the news hour. We begin in Russia, where police have launched a murder investigation after the daughter of a pro-Kremlin commentator was killed in a car bomb explosion near Moscow. Unverified social media footage showed Daria Dugina's father, Alexander, at the scene shortly after the bombing. Both have supported Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Well, Alexander Dugin is a Russian philosopher, political analyst and strategist. He was the chief editor at the pro-Kremlin Tsargrad TV station. Dugin was reportedly helped or shaped Vladimir Putin's expansionist foreign policies and has been called often Putin's brain. Now, he was involved in the Russian president's initiative for the annexation of Crimea and considered the invasion of Ukraine inevitable. Dugin has previously called for the eradication of Ukrainian identity.
I think that even though Daria Dugina has espoused very similar views to her father, particularly accusing the West of committing Nazism, calling for the annexation of all of Ukraine with the exception of Lviv, and the self-cleansing of Russian society, and her influence is drastically less than her father's.
Well, I mean, who would be the likely suspects? Because both the Kremlin and Ukraine are saying it's not them. But behind the scenes, was Alexander Dugin universally popular within Russia and specifically within the Kremlin?
So Alexander Dugin's actual influence over Russian policy has been grossly overstated. I reject the claims that he is Putin's Rasputin or Putin's brain, which is often the title that's been given him to the Western media. In fact, he never really held an official title within Russia. And his closest partners within the Kremlin were people like Sergei Glazyev, who were dismissed from the Kremlin in 2019. He isn't that in touch with the current establishment, least of all Putin. So I don't think it's really a strike at a major Russian foreign policy decision maker. Of course, the Russian foreign ministry is blaming Ukraine for this, saying that it's part of a pattern of Ukrainian terrorist activity, which extends to the attacks on Crimea, chemical terrorism, and now nuclear terrorism. And, of course, Zelensky's team is saying that Ukraine is not a terrorist state and doesn't commit crimes like this. So both sides are denying it. I think it's very unlikely that this was done to derail or disrupt Russian policy in any way. So Dugin has always been, to some degree, a hardline nationalist critic of Russian foreign policy, basically wanting to go much further than Putin is willing to go. Now he's calling for a general mobilization, a draft, conscription, and the complete movement until the historic destiny of Moscow and Kiev being united together is achieved. So he's always been pushing for more hardline views than the Kremlin has called for, so that's nothing new. Well, it will rattle the Kremlin if it was done by an external saboteur, but it won't rattle the Kremlin so much if this is some kind of an internal power struggle within the Russian security services between people who are trying to quash intellectuals like Dugin, who might fan the flames for a faster end to the war, a more efficient end to the war, or even support for the draft, which is something that the Russians don't want to do. They want to get as many volunteers as possible. They're even clearing people out of prisons, but they don't want to do conscription.
Have a prisoner union?
Yeah, they knew it was unconstitutional, the United States Supreme Court. But by that time, they had signed up thousands of prisoners all over the country in different states, you know, that had started their own, you know, union there in that state, you know, in the state prisons. But here's the deal, you know, all this came after the, you know, the Attica Rebellion. And the massacre there and everything. And the anger of the prisoners, you know, took various forms. You know, you had other rebellions and you had strikes and you had, you know, a number of things like that happen in local prisons. But then, you know, some people organized, I think it was in North Carolina as far as I can remember, the original prisoners' labor union was started by a guy named Jim Grant, who was a civil rights activist, and some other prisoners in the North Carolina state prison system. It also was going down in places like, you know, Walpole in Massachusetts, and that movement first was just, you know, the strike, and then after that. And they made contacts with activists on the outside, which is a common thing back in the 1970s and the 60s, was to make contacts with activists on the outside. And they were able to get some support from the outside. And so they started organizing a union. They didn't ask for a union. You know, they didn't say, can we have a union officer, you know, a warden? So they just started organizing unions all over. And it started just sweeping the country, you know. California had a big contingent, you know, and everything, and other states as well, you know, and it just started sweeping the country. And before long, thousands of prisoners were in these unions, and they were demanding, you know, prisoners' rights, and, you know, and the end to, you know, this beatings in prison and long-term confinement, you know, deprival of, you know, basic human rights and all this kind of thing. And so as it got stronger, it tried to build a central union, you know, and it was that point that, and this is after some years had gone down and after protests and organizing and people on the outside putting pressure on the government and so forth, after all this had gone on, then when they tried to create the central prisoners' labor union, you know, that's when the wardens from the prison, you know, the various state wardens, and prison wardens and so forth took them to prison, took them to court, to and wound up filing in the United States Supreme Court. I think it was 77 or 78 that they got the decision against the whole idea of this kind of movement being unconstitutional, they said, and a threat to prison security, you know. So, you know, it was interesting that at that time many of us, we had a split in our ranks. Because some of us believed that, you know, going to court and fighting and all this was a good thing to do. And others of us felt like we should just continue organizing and build the strongest possible movement that could even resist, you know, repression. And it didn't matter in the final analysis because they just, you know, came down on those of us that they thought were leaders and so forth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and just put us away, you know. Now, there's one thing, though, in the federal prison system, I met Jim Grant in prison. They shipped him out of North Carolina down to the Atlanta federal prison, and we had started to build a federal labor union, tried to do that, you know. And, of course, it was around that time that the decision came down and everything, and they isolated a bunch of us and all that.
Shit.
But here's the deal. The prisoners' labor union, the difference between it and just the strikers that we've seen in recent years is
it recognized, it was hooked up with the Black Power movement. You know, it was hooked up with the Black Power movement, the Civil Rights movement, and other organizations that were on, they're still alive on the outside, you know. And
well, that's the question. What would you say then of like the need to connect groups like Movement for Black Lives into more radical Black organizations that do like grassroots stuff on the outside with the prison movement?
Well, I'll say this, you know, and that requires some study, but I just off the hand, I would think that the movement, which has to be led by prisoners, and the movement on the outside has to be, you know, supportive of the prison struggle.
Yeah.
But like I'd written, you know, myself some time ago about how activists on the outside have got to start pressuring the state governments and you know, and the feds and everybody else, while the movement on the inside is building, you know, and it doesn't just mean standing on the outside with a ticket sign, but, you know, as I've written about going where the officials have their meetings and all these corporations that make money off of prison labor, you know, and there are quite a few of them, you know, expose that and some of the stuff that the Free Alabama movement had started to talk about in this period. We should be doing it that way, you know. And as far as organizations and movements, well, I'm not sure that those forces are looking for a mass campaign, a mass approach. They're, you know, when I was in prison, what broke up everything was this attempt by organizations on the outside to find some so-called leader or something on the inside or make him a leader, some prisoner. And he was spout their line and all this kind of thing. So
yeah.
I think, I'm not sure that these movements that exist right now would be willing or able to take leadership from prisoners. And I'm not sure, I don't know, you know, we can't say this is 1970 something, and the prison movement that existed at that time was, saw itself, and actually people on the outside saw it as being an autonomous protest movement.
You're bringing a much-needed critique right now.
Well, you know, it had already reached a high stage of development and struggle.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things to bear in mind. So you can't just get that overnight. Now, I think the movement now would be different and should be different. Technology or different political perspectives and so forth. And some of that's good, some of it's bad. I don't know how much on the inside there is with you know, for instance, Black Lives Matter and all that stuff, you know, to be quite honest. And it's a different kind of organization from most of the groups in the 1970s. It's much more of a petty bourgeoisie organization. And they're very sectarian in a lot of ways, you know. That's what I found. And but nevertheless, we're not talking about me. We're talking about the ability of the movement on the inside to see these as legitimate allies, especially in the Black community, which is really, really important and has been missing for so long. You know what I'm saying? Other than Attica, that moment with Attica, there has not been a mass base of support in the Black community for prisoners. But it just hasn't existed.
Well, I remember when we were talking about it had just been right after the prison strike in 2018. And
okay.
We were talking about the moment in, like, the late 90s where it was, like, 1998. There was critical resistance. There was
right.
the anarchist Black Cross, like, just emerges, kind of reemerges as a federation and a network. And then
right.
there's Insight, Women of Color Against Violence. So, like, there's this moment
yeah.
of Jericho. And then you're also even calling in 2002, you're calling for a united prison front, a whole united movement across, and you actually say verbatim, critical resistance, the North American anarchist Black Crosses, and all
mm-hmm.
movements for like queer, disabled, all oppressed people, colonized people,
yeah.
a united prison front. And so I just want to say that, like, that moment.
Yeah.
So
didn't come, though.
You agreed, right?
Well, bear this in mind. You know, it isn't really about organizations as much as it is about prisoners and their families and the communities they come out of, and what the state has done to communities of color ever since they resorted to the war on drugs, for instance, and with the and the rise of the police, paramilitary police, and all these kinds of things, you know. This was stuff that the original Black Panther Party had educated about and tried to fight about, you know. And they were trying to explain to white radical allies and so forth that the party, you know, we've talked about it, the party had a perspective on fascism and the state. And, you know, their thing was that they realized that, you know, prisoners could not free themselves. They could not liberate themselves. They had to be part of a broad-based mass movement. And that was actually starting to happen to some extent. And at first, as George Jackson was laying it out, you know, he was explaining a lot of things. Yeah, he was explaining a lot of things, but he was a key figure. And he's a key figure in explaining why we had to have this kind of unity.
You also talk about Martin Sostry.
Yeah, I do. Martin Sostry is my mentor, so what do you think, you know? But Martin was different. See, Martin, he came along before George did. And his organizing was to lay the basic foundation so that you could even read and talk about revolutionary activity, you know what I'm saying, or revolutionary politics. He laid the foundation of that with his lawsuits. And he said, we're not fighting the police. He said, we're fighting the state. You know, that's some profound shit.
So I have to say that there is some merit to what people are saying. I mean, you know, first and foremost, I would even say you need to start talking more shit about Tucker Carlson and his rants about his white nationalism. You need to be talking shit about Tim Pool.
Rod, don't do that. We're not talking about fucking Tucker Carlson. We're not talking about shit I should be doing. We're talking about this fucking guy and the Boogaloo Boys. I'm not talking. What the fuck are you doing?
Oh, okay, well then.
Can you talk about what we're talking about? I asked you about the Boogaloo Boys, and you start telling me what I should be doing with Tucker Carlson.
All right, well then let's go directly to his Twitter threads. Stuff. What about all this stuff from Magnus talking about his support of Kyle Rittenhouse?
Dude, I'm asking you about the Boogaloo Boys and what you know about them.
Okay, so.
And if what the ADL is saying is correct, is what the ADL saying, is that correct?
What I know about this particular Boogaloo Boy, Magnus Panvidya, in his own words on Twitter, he's talking about his support of Kyle Rittenhouse, and it's a hill that he's willing to die on. When asked whether he's left or right, and whether BLM is more important than what happened with Rittenhouse, he says, you know, he'll die on that hill, the Rittenhouse hill. And he says, I choose both / shrug.
I would be passing new ordinances relating to stiff criminal penalties for anyone who held a rave, the promoter, the guy who owned the building. I would put the son of a gun in jail. I would change the law. There's no doubt about where these raves are. In the middle of the desert. Arrest the promoter. Find a rationale unrelated to drugs. Keeping an unsafe example. I'm the guy who authored the crack house legislation. We can use the crack house legislation to tear down these buildings.
And it's Shut the Fuck Up Friday, so review the script. What do you say when the cop first pulls you over?
Why'd you pull me over?
And when he keeps asking questions?
I'm not discussing my day.
And they ask more questions?
Am I being detained or am I free to go?
And if detained, what do you say?
I invoke the Fifth.
And then what do you do?
You shut the fuck up.
Shut the fuck up Friday. Never answer questions when the cops ask.
Have safe holidays.
Tip of the day. And it's Shut the Fuck Up Friday, so review the script. What do you say when the cop first pulls you over?
Why'd you pull me over?
And when he keeps asking questions?
I'm not discussing my day.
And they ask more questions?
Am I being detained or am I free to go?
And if detained, what do you say?
I invoke the Fifth.
And then what do you do?
You shut the fuck up.
Shut the fuck up Friday. Never answer questions when the cops ask.
Have safe holidays.
Tip of the day.
We're from, my name is Commander Mike Lutz from the Homeland Security Section of the Sheriff's Office. We have Director Chris Peterson, who runs the Homeland Security Section for the Sheriff's Office, and Corporal George Bender. Individual hand sanitizer you can take with you, pin it on you, so this way you keep washing your hands, because D.C. is a dirty city. Never mind. Okay. Please, when you're out and about, stay in groups, especially if you're going to be wearing political clothing, because you will be a target, okay, if you're by yourself. Some of these anarchists will attack when you're by yourself. All right? They don't care who you are or what you are. They're going to go after you. You are allowed to defend yourself. Okay? But, again, that's D.C. It's not Florida. So they may look at you differently up there. So please be careful. But you know the press isn't going to be nice to you guys. So if you leave a mess, that's going to be broadcast on every news. Right? I don't expect this group to be that way. Please be polite to law enforcement. They have to be there. All right? I agree. We know this is not the group that we have to preach that to.
Some of these groups that, is, as you know, when these things happen, a lot of different groups show up. They're not necessarily who you think they are. The group itself may have morphed over time into something a little bit different than you thought, or they may be pretending to be somebody else. They may be pretending to be just an average Joe kind of to infiltrate your group, but that kind of stuff is going on in different forms all across the country.
Have a nice trip. Say hi to Donald for us, please.
On the hot seat, Jeff, it describes the scenario for an unnamed Miami firefighter who worked at a fire station like this one here in Coconut Grove. We don't yet have his name confirmed, but his written words sure to have people heated. There's serious heat on a Miami firefighter, and it's got nothing to do with being on the job. But for what was texted about the tragic shooting death of Miami-Dade police officer Cesar Echeverry, the fireman texting within a group chat, quote, "Who cares? Another dead cop, probably against gun control. They didn't give a blank when kids were dying in that school shooting. They stood outside. Cops exist for the government to exercise its monopoly on violence. They want the whole world to stop when one of theirs goes down. How many idiots I had to transport with honor guard their dead bodies from coronavirus because they all were too stupid to wear masks or get vaccinated. All cops are good for is protecting the rich property owners and the status quo. Everything else is a farce. Expletive the police."
That is officer down.
It's not the only eyebrow-raising commentary about Monday night's shooting.
Let them know they're going to have another officer down if they keep going at 70 miles an hour near my car.
That's from a City of Miami cop on police radio, commenting on other fast-driving officers rushing to assist following the Liberty City gunfire. He was promptly put in his place by a supervisor. As for the unnamed fireman's written remarks, his chief says, "We are conducting an investigation into the statements that were made, and the individual has been relieved of duty, pending the outcome of the investigation."
A history fact that just gets you choked up every time you have to tell it.
So when the Allied forces liberated the Nazi concentration camps at the end of World War II, and they were releasing the prisoners who had held there, and they asked them what all the symbols meant that they were wearing. So there was a Star of David, and that was for Jewish people, and there was another symbol for disabled people, and there was another symbol for Gypsy Roma travellers. And then they came to a symbol that they didn't know and didn't identify, which was the inverted pink triangle. And they asked the men who were wearing this, what does this symbol mean? And the men replied, we're homosexual, that's why we're in the concentration camps. So the Allied forces took all of those people who had the inverted pink triangles and sent them to German prisons to live out the rest of their life sentences. Gay men did not get saved at the end of World War II from the concentration camps. They got incarcerated.
Clara Sorrenti had London police show up at her doorstep with guns drawn. Now, this time the incident wasn't as serious, but how people online were able to find her whereabouts is equally as concerning. Aramark Khan has more.
I'm back. I'm back.
Love sign, Mark.
I got my stuff back.
Just a week ago, Clara Sorrenti was celebrating her return home and finally got her online streaming equipment back.
And I'm so happy.
Sorrenti had been recently doxxed. Someone sent a fake email with death threats using her name to London city councillors. The hoax email resulted in tactical police units arresting her at gunpoint at her home. Then it happened for a second time. This time, someone sent multiple pizzas from five different companies to her hotel room where she had relocated for safety reasons. London police say they're aware of the incident.
We're concerned. It's harassment. The whole occurrence was troubling from the outset, I think, until we slowed everything down and understood what are we dealing with.
Global News obtained the email used in the initial doxing. It gave out Sorrenti's real address and had threats of violence. But there were red flags visible in the email, according to one expert. Sorrenti's name was misspelled, and the email refers to her dead name, something a transgender person would not do.
You have to investigate these documents closely, and you have to look for those types of things so this exact situation doesn't transpire.
Outside the email, there are other concerns. Toronto Police Services got a similar email, but called Sorrenti. The trans woman alleges she also told London police in March she might get swatted. All those factors and her popularity included, Ali thinks police should have never shown up at her door.
The gay community.
Oh, wow. Why?
Because I love them so much. Because they don't ask me questions like that. Because they love sexual, strong women who speak their mind. You see, if I was a guy and I was sitting here with a cigarette in my hand, grabbing my crotch and talking about how I make music because I love fast cars and fucking girls, you'd call me a rock star. But when I do it in my music and in my videos, because I'm a female, because I make pop music, you're judgmental. And you say that it is distracting. I'm just a rock star.